Well, it is a great pleasure to meet Safia Khan. We're here at the University of Kent in Medway. And Safia, we haven't met before, but of course you do have a connection with this part of the world. So do you want to say a little bit, Safia, about what it is that you do?
Yeah, Chris, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It's a great honor to be here. Yeah, so I've been to KMTV a couple of times before, and it's been linked with events that we've been having at the mosque. It's not very far from here. The mosque is around the corner. So I am serving as an imam at the local mosque. I'm from the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, and the mosque that we have here actually represents the whole of Kent. So we have families and members spread across Kent, but most of the congregation, you could say, and members are concentrated around Medway. So yeah, I came here as an imam. In fact, I'm the first imam here at the mosque. The mosque didn't have any missionaries before. So I was sent here from the community in 2014. So since then, I've been here, and I've been able to establish, you know, a relationship with university as well as KMTV.
Yeah. And I'm guessing that you probably have contact with quite a few of the students who are either on this campus or more generally in
Yeah, absolutely. One aspect is obviously the media studies, and so regularly every year we get one or two students coming over and want to talk about Islamophobia or any particular topics that links to religion, and I think that's part of the training as well. So yeah, I've had a few students coming in, but then also we have invited Kent TV to come sometimes, cover the events as well. And yeah, sometimes students are invited to come to the mosque, and if they have any questions and they want to learn about Islam as a religion, then yeah, we do that as well with Mid-Kent College as well and schools. So we have school visits regularly as well, every other month. So it's a busy environment, and that's what we want the mosque to be.
Absolutely, and you've taken me back a few decades, because I used to live in Carmarthen in West Wales, and we used to teach first year Islam, and we'd take the students to Cardiff, actually, to a mosque. I remember we had a day of going to as many different religious sites as it was possible to do that covered the syllabus. Yeah. And it was so insightful, because I think I'm somebody who studied so much about religion in the classroom. I suppose my background is more in Christianity, but for me as well, to be teaching on whether it's Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, actually having a real sense about what it is to live in a community, to actually meet representatives of the tradition rather than reading the textbooks that might have been written sort of 20 or 30 years earlier. So that was always really eye-opening, and perhaps something I miss, actually, something I wish that I'd carried on doing where I am now. So I might take you up on the invitation that you kindly extended
course,
to me
course.
To visit your mosque as you're literally just around the corner from where we speak. So you've been here for quite a few years.
I've been here for quite a few years, and part of my work, you could say, or duties as a imam, as a missionary, is to lead the prayers every day at the mosque, take classes for children for their Quran learning, their religious studies. Apart from that, you know, if there are weddings or any other program, religious, you know, celebration days, for example, Eid, Ramadan. Ramadan is a whole month of fasting, for example, that happens. So at that time, particularly, the mosque is very busy with extra prayers, and sometimes we eat together as well as part of opening the fast together in the mosque as a community. So there's a lot going on, and in certain part of the year, things get more busy, you know, like Christmas is for the Christian community. So, but we... When the mosque was inaugurated by the worldwide head of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. So the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, just to tell you a little bit about it, it's a community that started in India, in Qadian, but it's spread in almost 200 countries now. And in UK, we have a large, fairly large community for about 35,000 members, and we have over 30 mosque centres across the UK, also in Cardiff, actually. So the community is spread throughout the world, really. So there's a one supreme head of the community who's called the worldwide head of the Ahmadiyya Muslim. He's also called a caliph, Now, caliph is something that we can talk about as well. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the word caliph. People think it's something political, something related to extremism, whereas the caliphs in the early Islam were spiritual leaders of the communities, and they, you know, they advocated for peace, for unity. And so our caliph as well, he doesn't have any, you know, land or any political position. He's a spiritual leader, and he just, you know, addresses and speaks to the community. Community members go visit him, and he you know, overlooks the community worldwide. So he lives actually in Surrey.
Yeah.
So we have a mosque in Tilford, in Surrey, where our headquarters is, you could say. So when he came to open this mosque, inaugurate this mosque in 2014, and he said a few things at that time. There were dignitaries, MPs, and councillors, and neighbors. We had a big program here. He said that make sure that this mosque, the name of the mosque is Nasir Mosque, and Nasir in Arabic means helper. He said make sure that this mosque is a helper for the wider community, so not just the, our own community, but make sure that you open your doors to the neighbors, to the community, invite them, so you can have a dialogue and you can talk to people, remove misconceptions that people have, or the anxieties people have sometimes with different religions, especially with Islam, and people might have questions and maybe some, you know, reservations. Make sure you reach out to people and remove those misconceptions and spread peace in Medway as well.
Yeah,
so I think that's been our goal, really.
Yeah, one of the things I remember just before Christmas last year, meeting an Anglican priest in Cardiff who was actually saying very similar to what you did, which was the importance of ensuring that the entire community is taken care of. So actually the way that the different traditions would meet up and share, and also just ensure that everybody is accommodated. Because,
yeah,
I mean, one of the things that certainly I've learned over many years is the idea that you can label people and sort of think, oh, that person is Christian or Muslim or Jewish, and somehow imagine that they are stand-ins for every particular representative or historical event or anything that's going on in the news. And actually, of course, human life is made up of a considerable amount of diversity, and also people who have a thirst for knowledge, for questioning, and also, as you say, dealing with misconceptions, which I'm guessing is probably quite an important part, but
very
also
important.
A very challenging part
of
what
yeah.
you do.
Yeah, no, I think, look, I'm going to be honest with you and say that it's not easy, because we witness Islamophobia from time to time. So there's a lot of, you know, I feel there's a lot of lack of knowledge and ignorance. And you can't really blame people as well, because I think that sometimes they don't get the right information. You know, media has a huge role to play, but media, sometimes you always get the bad news. You always get the negative, you know, at times. Not talking about Kent TV. Kent TV are brilliant. You know, they give a chance. They give voices to communities, which I think are really important to get the positive news out, because there's so much negative around that it's just depressing, and sometimes that results in anti-religious sentiments amongst people, whether it's Islamophobia or anti-Semitism. You know, it's just a reality that people face, and we have also faced it. But I think what we try to do is try to combat that with dialogue and with speaking with people. So, for example, just to give you an example, with the school visits, that so many children come, and they are sometimes surprised that we didn't know that we could actually come inside a mosque, that we were allowed. And also younger, elderly sort of people who come to the mosque, maybe from different communities, from churches, from backgrounds, even neighbors as well. So people who are not children, they're grown up, but they still didn't know that they could actually come into a mosque, and they didn't know that they could ask us any question. It was like, yeah, this is open for you as well. You can come, you know.
Yeah. So I often wonder what the seeds are of this, because, you know, media can play a big role in this. I was talking about that with my students just the other day. But it's often really challenging, because I suppose it must be very difficult for you as well in a community where you're dealing with a lot of prejudice that often has nothing to do with anything that you embody or represent, even anything that goes on in Medway, but it's from somewhere else.
Oh, yeah.
And that must be one of the biggest challenges.
That's the biggest challenge. I mean, look, I have been here for so many years, and apart from like small incidents here and there of Islamophobia, somebody yelling something or, you know, saying, oh, terrorist or this and that, apart from these things, you know, nothing really, you know, hateful. I can say that it's not a consistency of hatred. You know, people are generally very nice, you know, very mind their own business, you know, and when they're invited, they're quite happy, as I said, to come to the mosque. It changes their perspective. I'll give you another very kind of extreme example. So one very right-wing group, Britain First, you probably know about it. So they came to, we had like a outreach stall on Gillingham High Street. We do it in Rochester, Chatham, in Canterbury as well sometimes. And we had like a banner saying, love for all, hatred for none, you know, Islam means peace, come talk to us, you know. So there was a chap who came over and he was from Britain First and he was quite aggressive. So instead of becoming aggressive yourself, you kind of sometimes have to absorb it and understand that that person, that's all the knowledge that that person have. So this is an opportunity for you to speak. So we spoke to the person very nicely and kindly and said to him, look, we are not terrorists. First of all, we wouldn't be here. So secondly, you know, our religious teachings are not such. Let me tell you what, you know, Islam means. And, you know, it's about religious freedom. Everybody should be able to believe wherever they want to believe. There's no force. You can't force anyone. You have to live in harmony. Islam means peace. And we told, after good conversation, that person was quite happy. And, you know, it changed his mind. And, you know, he left with a smile and we were happy as well. Yeah. It shows that sometimes you need to have tough confrontations or talks with people in order to remove some of the questions and misconceptions that they have in their minds.
I mean, that's a huge accomplishment, really, because the fear, and I suppose you always see it when I've been at supermarket checkouts sometimes, and when they discover that I teach religious studies, suddenly it's almost as though this whole can of worms has opened up. That would never happen in a teaching environment, because somebody will suddenly say, oh gosh, religion is responsible for dot, dot, dot. And of course, you know, you're just standing there buying your groceries, and then suddenly you kind of feel that you're embodying something which is a problem for them. But actually, when somebody came over in anger, and then you, of course, didn't respond in anger, then of course, in a way, that would have wrong-footed them. But it sounds like that was a lone individual. I suppose when you have a whole group, then that can be really tough, or when it's orchestrated. And I can imagine that that must be really hard.
We had the group as well coming. Yeah. The same group from the same organization came to our mosque. This was, I think, in the first year when I came, 2014. So I was new, you know, in my business, you could say. So, but at that time we were working in the garden. So our mosque is quite high in the back of the garden. So they were outside. The mosque is always locked because it's right on the road, so for security reasons. So we're working in the back garden. We're, you know, mowing the lawn and just tidying up. And then we heard some people yelling and shouting. And we came around the fence, and they were outside, like the whole group of them, in the green jackets and, you know, full going at it. And at that time you couldn't really talk to them because all they were doing were yelling, and we were like, you know, please leave us alone. We were not interested. And they want to open the mosque. We want to go inside the mosque. We're like, the mosque is closed. Thank you very much. See you later. Bye-bye. So this happened. They apparently recorded it as well, put it on their Facebook page, whatever. But, you know, as you said, when they're a group of people, it can be intimidating, and then you have to act otherwise. You have to protect yourself and you have to report it to the police and do the right thing. And
I think it comes down to the integrity of what somebody does and what someone stands for. Because, of course, it's always very insightful when somebody is shouting, but the person at whom they're yelling is not reciprocating with yelling. So it's like somebody is shouting, but it's not a dialogue.
Yeah.
And he's thinking, well, if somebody's not shouting back at you, why do you need to shout? And of course, they're not shouting at you. Of course, that's the problem. That they're shouting because all their prejudices are coming out, and you're unfortunately the beneficiary. That's hardly the right word, but you're the representative of that.
I remember I was smiling, and one of the guys went, "What are you smiling at?" I was like, "I don't know the answer to that." Okay, what was I supposed to say? You know, you're gonna listen. Mm. But yeah,
it's one of those things, isn't it, where sometimes there's no blueprint for how to respond to a particular situation. But I suppose, and I'm guessing that that would happen in the community as well, that you would work together to try and say, okay, this is what happened on this occasion. How do we best share good practice?
Yeah, and I think that religious that's where religion comes in, right? Mm. So from an early childhood, I've been, you know, taught religious teachings or manners and way of life by my parents and my community. So, you know, one of those things are, if somebody's abusing you, yelling you, and is not interested in talking to you, then don't respond back with the same aggressiveness. Don't respond back with abuse, because it's not going to take you anywhere. So you be quiet, pray for them, and if there is an opportunity to talk to them in a rational way, then do that. But show your good example. And that's really important in Islam as well, because Prophet Muhammad, the founder of Islam, the Prophet of God, he used to be abused all the time. People used to throw rocks at him, whatever, you know, when he was preaching, and he would not respond back. He would just pray for them that, yeah, maybe they're doing it now, but maybe the time will come, God will change their heart. And exactly, Prophet Jesus as well, you know, the persecution that he had to go through, and other prophets as well. So that is an example, I think, which is really important. And these are the things which I think religion teaches us, and this is why religion is so relevant, because nowadays people think that religion is not relevant, and almost 50% of the UK population don't really follow religion or associate themselves with any religious beliefs. But I think manners, good conduct, good morals, these are the things that originates from religion, from Christianity, from Judaism, from Islam, all these religions. Me as a Muslim, we believe that all these religions are sent from God over different times. And they all have good things in them that we need to follow.
Yeah, and I think the education that you mentioned is so important, because, again, obviously I've always been worried that there's sort of the ivory tower element, that, you know, I can teach, I mean, I can stand in front of a class of students and talk about Islam or Judaism, but knowing full well that I'm doing that without any kind of insider understanding, or well, that's not entirely true, because, you know, like conversations like this. But I think the problem I've always had is how you can turn a sensible two-way conversation where you're always learning something. And there's no point having a conversation unless you're mutually learning or gaining, you know, from the other person, or being fortified by that other person, or somebody saying something that is making you think in a different way, and you go back and reflect on that. And I suppose my concern is what happens when the people who are shouting don't have that background. There's something going on there, which, of course, has nothing to do with you personally, although it feels very personal. And it's combating that I have the real problem with. Because if only was to start shouting at me, I would take it hugely personally. Mm. I think back of, you know, school bullies. Mm. I wonder if those bullies, in years to come, ever look back and reflect on what they did.
Yeah.
Maybe they have children of their own, and maybe it never occurs to them.
For them,
you know, do they ever look back and think, oh, maybe that wasn't the right way to do things? And I always wonder, because we all have, and it's come up in quite a lot of the interviews I do about the people who do the persecuting and how awful it is, and the way that you don't forget these things. They're traumatizing episodes. Mm. But is that person stuck in stone? Is the person doing that, do they have the capacity to change? Are there any experiences or any particular instances that we're aware of where we can say, okay, that person did a bad thing, but actually, like the guy who came up to you from Britain First, who came away with a smile on his face and maybe realised that, you know, he was picking the wrong fight. That for me is interesting, but there isn't a part of me that wants to go and interview those people, but I'm interested in whether there is a journey there, and I hope that there is.
Yeah, I hope that it is, and I think there always is a chance, because sometimes people are just, you know, fed hate, and that's all they know. Yeah. So once they see something different, it changes them. Like, I'll give you another example. For example, this is the time of Prophet Muhammad, right? Where he was preaching, and he was Islam had just started in Mecca. He was persecuted for 10 years over there because they had different beliefs. So there was a woman who used to throw rubbish at him every time he would walk past her house. So she would stand on the roof, throw rubbish on him every time. And he would just walk past, right? Rush and walk past. One day he didn't. One day she didn't. She wasn't there. And Prophet Muhammad was on his walk, you know, like regularly. And he noticed it was odd. There was no rubbish thrown on him this time. So instead of being happy, he went and visited her, knocked on her door, and when he went in with permission, he saw that she was sick. And Prophet asked how she was doing and tended for her, like, you know, helped her, you know, with whatever she needed. And that changed her.
Yeah.
That changed her. She became a Muslim. So I think so many of these stories we find in the early scriptures and the religious stories. However, I think that this is always the case, even today. This is why we should never give up on anyone. Everybody has a chance. And when the time is right, when that turning point comes, and it comes in everybody's life, that's the chance for those people also to change. Because I can give you another example. Recently, just like a month ago, I think we were doing another outreach stall in Rochester. And this, obviously with Israel-Palestine conflict that's happening, is very fresh, raw. So we were standing there and we had the same banner, Islam means peace, love for all, hatred for none, you know. The books and leaflets and stuff for people to take if they wanted to. And a woman comes up to me and she says, "This is not true. Islam is not peace. You're terrorists." So I was like, okay. And then she went back and she came back again. And she said that, "Why are you doing this? If you're terrorist. Your Islam is not peaceful religion." So I was like, "Maybe you are a terrorist." Like, just, you know, not aggressively, but just to put the question to her, "Maybe you are a terrorist." And she was like, "Do you know who I am?" I was like, "No." And she was like, "I'm a former IDF. I'm a former ex-military Israeli, you know, force." So I was like, "Okay, that's fine. I mean, in that case, you know, you might have done a lot of things which are of extreme nature, you know, like innocent children." And then she became a bit aggressive and she was like, "No, but you are starting the extremism and this and that." So I said to him, "Look, I only put the question to you because without you really knowing me, called me a terrorist. So I, without knowing you, if I call you the same thing, you get offended, right?" So that's how the conversation started. And then I said to her, "Look, I feel very sad and obviously hurt by what happened on 7th October, and innocent people were killed, and that shouldn't have happened. And I mourn every innocent life that get lost." And I said, "But look, there's also atrocities happening from the Israel side." I said, there's been an occupation for 50 or so years, and regularly Palestinian people are being killed by Israel, so you should condemn that too, right? So those are, you know, they're humans on both sides, and the innocent people suffering because of political leaders making, you know, ignorant choices or selfish choices. So then she calmed down, and then I was like, "Look, you know, Judaism, we as Muslims, we believe in Moses, we believe in your religion. Islam is in fact the only religion where you are obliged, you have to believe in the truth of all religions, you know, even Jesus you have to believe in, Moses you have to believe in, all prophets. If you reject one, you cannot be a true Muslim." So Prophet Muhammad, from Prophet Muhammad all the way to Prophet Adam, all prophets you have to accept, and all prophets you have to believe that their teaching in their original form was from God, and it was right. Yes, with the passage of time, things change, and yeah, you know, scriptures also change. So I said to her that, "Look, we believe in one God, and Jews also believe in one God." So I said, we're very similar, you know. However, whatever is happening in Middle East is not a religious war. It's a political war. It's about land. It's about, you know, greed. It's about these political tensions which have been there for years, and who are suffering? Innocent people. And we want the suffering to stop, right? For both. We want Jews and Muslims and Christians to live peacefully together. And in history, it's shown that for more than 100 years, Jews, Muslims, Christians have been living peacefully in Jerusalem and in the Middle East. So when we had this discussion, she was completely changed as a person. And you know what? When she left, she said, "God bless you" to me. And I said, "God bless you too." So it was just a beautiful example of how... So I had no idea that I would meet an IDF ex-soldier on Rochester High Street, right? But that conversation ended on a positive note.
Yeah, and I think what you've just proven is the, on your part, the amazing keenness to try and get to the root of what is going on, because I think there is a lot more we have in common. I remember, I mean, there's two thoughts on that. One is, I remember being at university and we had a very eminent philosopher of religion come to speak, and he was like, yeah, Christians, Jews and Muslims all worship the same God. And he was right, although there are lots of differences. Yeah. Rather than said they're all the same. I think then it was sort of, oh, well, actually, it doesn't matter which one you know, and that's not true, because there are traditional particularities and cultural specificities, which also you can't sort of, otherwise you're saying that everybody who's religious is the same. You know, I've got some wonderful philosopher colleagues who sometimes imagine that somehow if you're studying religion that you're promoting God, and you think, well, that there are many steps before you get to that state. That's not quite what we do.
Yeah.
But what it also shows is that there is a common humanity and a common humility, I think, which is often lost. I mean, my sense after what happened on the 7th of October, which was ironically, it was the weekend that the film about Golda Meir, you know, the Israeli Prime Minister from the 70s, came out with Helen Mirren. And that came out, and I was watching the film and just thinking, gosh, this could almost be today's news. Mm. And what struck me was that the lessons of history, haven't been learned, that... You know, I remember growing up, and I remember all the attempts that Clinton made to try and bring the sides together in 1993, particularly, Arafat, and then it just felt, gosh, you know, is this ever going to be resolved? And I don't know, and I feel we're further away at the moment, but also there is, I think, a clear set. I mean, at the moment that we're speaking, there is a temporary truce. Let's see how long that lasts. A pause. But I wonder whether there are lessons that can be learned, who's going to learn them, whether, like in Northern Ireland, whether a new generation can actually see things with different eyes and where there is peace. I mean, the political structures in Northern Ireland at the moment are not good, because you don't even have a working assembly, but there isn't violence on the streets. Was a generation ago, that was the case. And South Africa, maybe, I don't know if that's a good analogy as well, but I wonder whether there is a way forward. Am I being optimistic? Or is this, do you think, unfortunately, just sort of something that is never going to be solved?
I think if there's absence of justice, peace will not prevail. There is hope, because I feel that there are innocent people, and interestingly, most Jewish people are against what Israel is doing. So this whole thing that is anti-Semitic to criticize Israel at their actions is wrong, because most Jewish people are against it. So I think that there's a lack of justice. So, for example, you know, what happened on 7th October was horrible, you know, and it's denounced, and of course rightly so, you know, don't go and kill innocent people. But there was obviously a boiling point, right? So Gaza is, I think, as you know, is completely closed from all sides with huge walls, right? Yeah. And even from the sea, Gaza only are allowed for a couple of miles to do fishing. So from all around, it's encircled and closed. And everything that comes out and in from Gaza is controlled by Israel. So they are basically living in a prison, you could say. Yeah, with the life that they can live, some good things that they have. But apart from that, they are controlled. Mm-hmm. So for many years, and I feel like then you have the West Bank, where Hamas is not there, but then there are Palestinian children being killed as well recently. And on a regular basis, over the 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you know, it happens regularly, right? They are taken and taken to prisons. Yeah, some of them might be criminals, so they might have done something. But then you look at the situation, and you look at, here's something that really is bothering me, because I find it very hypocritical that the whole of the West, including UK, America, all European countries, immediately said we stand with Israel, right? Without even ignoring the whole thing that what's happening before. At that time, nobody raised any voice for the Palestinians, right? And even what happened after October 7th, I personally think that going and bombing, carpet bombing a whole densely populated area just because of Hamas and what they did is not going to solve the situation. Now 15,000, 16,000 people have been slaughtered, 6,000 children. You look at Hamas and how they came in power, and over the years you will see that the children who have had their entire families wiped out by bombing, parents killed, orphan children, they have no jobs, they have no prosperity there, they have no future. What are they going to do? They're going to be radicalized, right? Or they're going to have a hatred towards what's on the other side of the walls, right? So they will always think, how can we break free? How can we get out of this? How can we liberate ourselves? So some people might call it extremism or terrorism, but you have to look at it from the other side, that what choice do those people have? If they don't resist, their life is going to continue to be like that, right? So I think justice is very important, and for the international community to also be just, you know. Yes, Israel is an ally politically, but humanity, where is the humanity, right? You have to, if you stand with the Israelis, then you also have to stand with the Palestinian people. And it's not enough saying that we're not going to advocate for a ceasefire, we're only going to advocate for pause so humanitarian aid can come in. So what happens next? Humanitarian aid comes in, people get a little bit of food, okay, let's start bombing again, yeah? So the more people are killed, the more chances are that the next generation who see their parents, who see their whole families, neighborhoods being turned to rubble, they're not going to love Israel, are they? They're going to hate it. So that hate will just increase, and it will not give any chance for peace.
And I was just thinking about those tensions in the Labour Party, where, as you say, there was a very clear sense of this side is right, this side is wrong. And then, of course, there was a rebellion within the party, and then a slightly more nuanced position came out. But it was a bit of a fudge, really, in terms of, you know, actually perhaps acknowledging without saying so that that wasn't really, that didn't bring people on board. It's, I think it's very unhelpful, particularly yeah. if you're somewhere else in the world, to pronounce, you know, exactly on something about which, you know, a lot of people are have family members. I think of the First Minister of Scotland, who of course actually had family. I think it was his wife's parents who were over there, and I think it's that personal nature that I think is something that is forgotten in what can often be a very black and white conflict. But have you ever been to that part of the world? Have you ever been to the Middle East?
I have not actually. So that's another thing, that again, world leaders went to Israel, they saw what happened on 7th October. And again, we never deny it. We never deny that what happened was wrong, right? Where innocent people should not be killed. And what Hamas did, yes, you know, if they killed innocent people, that's wrong. That should not be, it should be denounced. But everybody went there. Nobody went to Palestine. Nobody went to see the destruction there. Nobody went to see what kind of conditions they live in. Or the West Bank, where Palestinian people are regularly harassed, tried to by the illegal settlers, basically. So every international law is broken, but when people see that only one set of people are being targeted or being kind of pushed down on, and the other people who are committing the atrocities and breaking international laws are not being held accountable because they are allies, then people see the hypocrisy, and people, I think people are waking up to this. They're seeing this now, that there is another agenda behind it, and unfortunately, it does take people to the path of radicalization. And we want to prevent that, right? We want peace for both people. But the only way you're going to get peace is with justice.
Yeah, and you just made me think, actually, of Joe Biden, who I remember, he went to Israel. I think there was a plan, I don't know, that he was going to meet Palestinian leaders, but they didn't want to meet him, or then he spoke to them on the plane home and there was some announcement about aid. It felt all so wrong in so many ways to go all that way and then have a conversation from an aeroplane and then say, well, we've got an agreement with Egypt or whatever it was. And that did feel as though, you know, I suppose there was they knew that there was maybe moderating influence. But it's not... I think, you know, growing up and witnessing this, it's I feel very powerless in this. I have one student from Iran. I have students from the part of the world where I kind of realize sometimes just how lucky, how privileged my life is. But then there is always that sense of, you know, what can I do? What am I able to do? Am I able to do nothing at all? But you can't turn a blind eye to what's going on. And it just spirals.
Yeah, I think there's things we can do. I think we should hold our political leaders accountable. And I think people are speaking out, even some MPs. But again, those who speak out are pushed down upon. Even those MPs who have gone against their party's decisions to call for a ceasefire have been removed or have been reprimanded. So I think we have power. People can. I think people want to see peace. I'm not entirely sure what the plan is of the political leaders and governments, but I think people want to see peace. And what our community has done is that we have had an active campaign to write to our MPs to ask them to ask for ceasefire and back a ceasefire and back a long-term solution for peace for both Israel and Palestine. Because we have community in Israel as well as in Palestine. So we have communities in both places. And we know that the suffering, the only way people can live in peace is if there's justice on all sides, if people are given their rights, right? If Palestinians are able to live their lives freely and not, taking their rights away, then there will be peace. Then they won't do these things, right? That's what we can do. And then the other thing we really focus on is on prayers, because we believe that we might be powerless because we don't have any authority. But God is certainly watching, and He has the power to change the things. And we believe that if we all truly pray for peace and the removing of afflictions for all people suffering, innocent people suffering, then things will change.
And you're such, just listening to you talk, you're sounding just so, you have a really good grasp of the situation. Did politics ever, have you ever considered going into that sort of area of discourse?
I hate politics because of these things. I think that religion is the way forward for me, because, politics, there's always something. There's so many lies, so many deceptions. And it's just heartbreaking that ultimately it's innocent people who are suffering, right? So I have never considered to be a politician or to be in politics. But regarding the situation,
You're certainly a good spokesperson, though. That's what I'm thinking, that in terms of actually getting a message across.
I think that we have a duty as faith leaders to speak out. So every time there's been a terrorist attack, or some kind of extremist incident, I've always spoken out. I've always reached out to media to say that, look, from an Islamic point of view, this is wrong. For example, anything that happened in London, London Bridge or whatever, this is not Islam. Islam condemns terrorism, really. It talks about living in peace. You don't harm other people. Innocent people are not supposed to be harmed. Even in war, Islam has some very, very strict rules. Islam says that you're only allowed to fight those who fight you, as in soldiers. Islam is against this whole idea of bombing, using bombs that can destroy whole neighborhoods. How do you know who's innocent, who's not innocent? There could be families and there could be people affected. Islam says you're not allowed to destroy infrastructure. Yeah, you're not allowed to harm any civilians. You're not allowed to cause harm to or attack mosques or places of worship, whether they're Christian, Muslims, Jewish, any. And you're not allowed to harm any children. You're not allowed to harm any elderly. You're not allowed to cut trees. These are the Islamic rules of.
I'll be honest, laws. I didn't know that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And wars as well is only permitted in self-defense. It's not, you're not allowed to go and attack somebody because of your selfish desires for land or for power. You're allowed to do it in self-defense only. And Islam says that if the other person stops, then you should also stop. There's no reason to keep going on, fighting. So, unfortunately, you could also say Muslims around the world have forgotten the Islamic teachings. And In many countries such as Afghanistan and in other places where jihad is often used as a mean to attack other people, it's against Islamic teachings. Jihad is really, first of all, the most important, the meaning of jihad is struggle. And the main jihad is to struggle to improve yourself as a human being. The Prophet said that this is jihad akbar, meaning this is the biggest jihad, the most important one, is to improve your soul. And the second is to preach and to speak to people about peace and dialogue. And the third kind of jihad is the jihad of arms, meaning that you can defend yourself. So if you're attacked, and it's not politically, it's categorically mentioned in the Holy Quran that if people deny you from following or practicing your religion and attack you for that specific reason, or if you're defending your own house, that is particularly jihad. You're allowed to do that. And other than that, that is not classed as a jihad. That is a war that could be for many reasons. It could be political reason, geographical, whatever. But jihad is very sacred, you could say, word. And often it's thrown out there, for example, in the media as well. Jihad is this, not jihad. So I have always spoken about this when these things happen, that please do not use that word, because that word is actually very, very limited to, and it has a very, very specific rules, so it cannot be used like that. Muslims need to also get a grasp of their religious teachings and not misuse their teachings for their personal gain. But on the other side, as I said, there is a huge hypocrisy, there is a huge injustice which is being done in Palestine at the moment.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you about your own journey here as well, because as an imam, tell me about that journey. How did you get to where you are now? Was that something that you expected? Was that something that, was it a journey that has, looking back, an inevitability to it? Because you mentioned that you've always wanted to be a spokesperson for faith, for Islam. But is that something that you could have imagined that you'd be doing as you look back from where you are now?
I've never really not thought of it as being a spokesperson. But what I've really been interested in is about removing misconceptions and tell people about true Islam, really. Because when I was growing up, and I have to admit, I was in a, my parents very religious. My whole family is really religious, and we were very connected to our mosque. I was born in Norway, actually. Yeah, wow. So I used to go to the mosque on the weekend, and my dad was the administrative head of the community for a very long time. So I was in the mosque most of the time, right? And helping him, and making tea as well for him. So I've done that a lot. So I was very attached to the mosque. And then when I was growing up, I saw at that time, because obviously 9/11, and from that time we have continuously seen an increase in Islamophobia. We've continuously seen incidents in the Muslim world, and I always wondered that, why is this happening? And when I started learning about Islam, when I started focusing and learning the Holy Quran and the Islamic teachings, I saw that these teachings are completely opposite to what terrorism is, what extreme. So why is it that such people are doing such things in the name of my religion? And I, kind of decided that time that my mission, I would love to do this in my life, that I would go and tell people what Islam is and remove those misconceptions. And that was basically what the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is all about as well. So as I said, I was very involved in the community from the first. So I went and met the worldwide head of the community as well, and he said that, why don't you join our institution of missionary training, and you become a missionary for the community, and then we send you somewhere the way you can do this work.
Yeah, and so was this in Norway? Were you still in Norway at this point?
I was in Norway, so the headquarters is here in UK. It used to be in London, now it's moved to Surrey. So I came to Surrey to meet the head of the community, the Caliph, and then I decided, okay, I'll do this. We have an institute here as well, Institute of Modern Languages and Theology, Imam Studies here in the UK, registered everything. So it's a campus. You live there. You have your own room and you study there. 7 year study, so it's a long study, 6 years, and then the last year you work on a thesis, and you also do some practice at different places. So I did that here in the UK. So from 2006, I was in the UK. I came to the UK. And then 2013, when I finished, then I went to Sierra Leone, to Africa, to do a little bit of practice. Yeah, it was a very good experience. And the reason we also sent there is because once you get a whole different environment, and also you learn how lucky you are, how fortunate you are, when you see the condition of some people living there, the poverty, as well as you know, the lack of resources as well. So I had that experience, which was great. It was fantastic. People there were so lovely, and they had a different kind of spirituality, which really inspired me. I mean, their dedication, their belief in God was so strong, even when they didn't have anything, right?
Yeah.
So I feel the more things that you have, the more distractions you have sometimes as well. The materialistic things that you have around you, the comforts you have, makes you forget that your connection with God could be disrupted. But I felt that those people were very, very spiritually strong, you know, in their prayers, and they're very strong in their faith. So I spent about 2 months there in Sierra Leone, teaching and meeting people, going to villages, preaching as well, playing football with some very talented Sierra Leoneans. And then I came back, and we were sent to Spain for preaching and for learning experience. We did a lot of leafletting in Spain. And then I came back, and then I went to Pakistan. Pakistan, we have our second headquarter. Well, basically, it was actually the original headquarter. It moved from India to Pakistan. Now it's two headquarters there as well. But in Pakistan, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, really, I don't know if you know about this, but we're a persecuted community in Pakistan, a minority.
Yes.
And from many of them don't, well, the Pakistani system doesn't recognize us as Muslims. We don't have the right to call ourselves Muslims in Pakistan. So we're a persecuted community very much in Pakistan. But so I went there as well to gain a little bit of experience. And then I came back, and I was told Gillingham is your next destination. I didn't even know where Gillingham was. So I came here, and I was like, oh, this is far. Far from London, how am I going to survive this?
Yeah.
And now I can't even think of going back to London, because I love it here.
No, well, you wrong-footed me when you mentioned Norway. I wasn't expecting you to say that you were born in Norway. But I've got to ask you...
My parents... My parents, then, they were persecuted in Pakistan. My father actually had an assassination attempt on him, so he had to flee the country, so... my family then came to Norway and sought refuge, and then they've been in Norway since, was it 1987, I think. So I was born in 1990,
right,
in Norway. Norway is a lovely country, amazing.
Yeah.
If there's one place that I would love to go back, it would be Norway.
Yeah, and you were there until how old were you when you left Norway?
When I was 17, yeah. I think, yeah.
Yeah, so I've got to ask you, when you went to all these, you know, I mean, breathtaking to have travelled, you know, for far more than I have ever done. But do you have kind of mementos, diaries, records, conversations that you still have? Maybe you're still in touch with some of the people from that time. Because I have, you know, obviously we all have regrets, but sometimes I wish I'd had more, I'd kept more for future proofing. Because if people make an impression on you, you mentioned the footballing, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess some people are happy just to leave the past alone and say, well, it happened then, and it, you know, it was great, and now we move on. But also, there's a part of me which may have precipitated the nostalgia interest, that there's also plenty of things in the past, we'll come on to this, that maybe we want to let go of and you know, really don't want to dwell on. But also there are many things that have moulded us and made us who we are. And I always think back on the people who made an impression on me and the places that made an impression on me. And there is a part of me that needs almost to continue to celebrate maybe almost those experiences, because and almost to continue the dialogue, actually, which I've successfully done, actually, through reconnecting with people, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years. But in your case, is there a sense in which you've taken a part of your time in Spain or Sierra Leone or Norway, indeed, Pakistan, back with you, and that is very much part of your day-to-day living now?
Yeah, I would say so. Because I've enjoyed all of these experiences, really. It's been, and I think that's when we were going to Africa, to Sierra Leone, there was a bit of anxiety that how am I going to survive this, right? Like, we are kind of, you know, brought up here in the European environment where you have everything, right? You have electricity, you have running water, you have, everything is safe, yeah? But over there, you know, I had to have... disinfect my water that I was using, making sure that I was drinking, clean boiled water, things like that, which our poor stomachs cannot, you know. Yeah. So things like that, there was a bit of anxiety, and but I think when I went there, just the experience, just the people there, just the community there as well, and the chance you have to serve, right? And I think that's really important, because I was able to. I was fortunate to be able to teach in a school. I was fortunate to be around people, just do small things which really are not really really meaningful in the broader sense, but if you're able to help people, even with small things like just food and things like that, and you see the smile on people's faces and what it means to them, they remember you for life, right? Yeah. And I think that experience was so rewarding that that has changed my life in a way that when I face any difficulty, I don't think of it as a difficulty, right? I think of it as a challenge, but I always think that, look, there are people over there that you saw who are walking barefoot to go to school for over a mile, and they're happy with smile on your faces. So if you have to go get up in the morning to do something, you're lucky that you have a car that you can sit in to go. You're lucky that you have a warm house that you are enjoying. You're lucky that you have a phone. You're lucky that you have electricity. You can charge your phone at any time. Couldn't do it over there. You had specific times where the electricity would be there. Other times there would be no electricity. So you had to use that time to charge. And even I was lucky that I actually had that electricity. A lot of people don't have it at all. So I think what it teaches you is gratefulness, and I think gratefulness is such an important part to have in your life, in your mind always. Be grateful for what you have, because there are so many people who are less fortunate than you, but they're more happy. So I think that's really important, and that's just Africa. In Spain, I had other, you know, experiences, doing preaching, leafletting, talking to people, gave me confidence. Now I don't feel scared going on the street and stopping people and say, hey, do you have any questions about Islam? You know, it takes, you sometimes are nervous doing that, but I don't feel that now, because that I'm over that that fear, because I've done it so many times. So
I think that sometimes when you are a particular person, and often age is something with this, because, you know, sort of, I look back on my younger self and can see, yeah, all the seeds of what I'm doing now were there, but I just didn't, perhaps, or I was a bit too shy to try and know exactly how to manifest those. But from everything that you're saying, if, and it's the integrity thing, that if you are who you are, and if you weren't doing what you're doing on the streets and going and talking about Islam, then you wouldn't feel rewarded. You'd feel that you were missing something. I mean, actually, lockdown for me, when I was still teaching my students, but I was teaching in a virtual way. Mm. I wasn't having that commute to work. I didn't have the luxury of being able to, you know, interact with people over a coffee, you know, in the Gulbenkian cafe, wherever. That all felt very diminished.
Yeah.
I felt that there was a whole world going on there.
Yeah.
And I realised that an insular kind of life, I mean, there are times in life when maybe sometimes you don't have the luxury of being able to, maybe too ill to be able to get out of the house.
Yeah.
So long as I am able to get out, I want to make the most of every day.
Yeah.
And I find that it's when you set your own boundaries that something recalibrates.
Yeah.
That sometimes, you know, the busier you are, the more time for the unexpected that you encounter, because you don't, you know, sometimes you can't accentuate the negative as much as you might if you're sort of sitting and feeling a bit sort of morose. But I suppose that leads on to a question I always ask in this podcast, which is whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. I think you've touched on that actually quite eloquently up to this point, but the way that those things make us maybe stronger people, that we benefit from those challenges. but also a sense in which sometimes we can look back and say, gosh, you know, I did that outside of my comfort zone, maybe. I'm the person I am now because I went through that. Can you be nostalgic for those kind of experiences?
Yeah, I think you can. And I think it's a learning experience. And I think it's how you look at it. So you can look at something and say, oh, I was really unfortunate that I had to go through that. But that's not going to help you. You can look at something and say, I learned from that. So every mistake that you make, every challenge that you face, you know, I think it's the best way to look at it is that what can I learn from that? You know, how can I make sure that I don't fall in the same trap or I don't repeat that same mistake or that thing doesn't happen to me again? What can I do? And what can I do to reduce that those chances? I think that's really important. There are always things that happen in your life that you, it's not in your control. And sometimes there are, you know, challenges. And I think of it as a test from God, because God says in the Holy Quran as well that sometimes we do try you with afflictions. Sometimes we try you with illness, try you with the loss of, you know, life, loss of business, loss of money. So these things are a trial. You can give up and blame God and say, you know what, it wasn't my fault. But at the end of the day, you'll be there, you know, thinking about it all the time. It's not going to help you with anything.
And it's the great question of the ages, the theodicy question, the whole problem of evil, and, you know, and what you learn from that. I mean, that's one of the real struggles. There's evil in the world, but it's how you respond to the
how
evil
do you
can
respond
often be
to
far
it, yeah.
more important than seeing the evil alone as an isolated
and being depressed
thing.
About yeah. it, yes. Yeah. Exactly, because, as I said, these afflictions, trials, they can bring you closer to God.
Yeah.
They can reignite your relationship with God, I think, because, as I said, sometimes we... because of the comfort zone that we are in, because of the routine that we have in our life, we forget that we need to be challenged in the spiritual way as well. And those challenges come when you are in difficulty. So whenever I have faced difficulty, I've seen that, like with everybody, you get anxious, you know, you feel sad, you feel that the whole world is against you. But in actuality, that's the chance for you to turn that into a positive. So I have always seen that if I pray at that time, my prayers are different. There's more anxiety in my prayers. There's more zeal in my prayer. There's more passion in it. There's more emotion in it. Whether otherwise, in normal circumstances, where everything is fine, your prayer might not be as strong. Your connection with God might not be as strong. But it is strong when you face difficulties. And I think that gives you strength as well.
Yes, and there's also the paradox that if we don't have those difficulties or challenges...
How are we supposed to know what...
Yeah.
Appreciate or be grateful of.
Because we don't want them. I mean, sometimes you think, gosh, I just want a relaxing day or something.
Yeah.
But actually, when you have the relaxing day, you feel, no, there's something wrong. You feel guilty.
Yeah.
You're not doing the things.
Yeah.
That
not productive, matter. Exactly, yeah.
So maybe it's in built in us. But I've got one more question for you, which is the way I always finish the podcast, which is to ask whether, Sophia, you're... a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
A bit of both, I think. A bit of both. Looking back, you always think that you did something. Could you have done it better? The decisions that you made, were they the right decisions? Maybe you should have done things differently, and I'm sure that's the case. I do think about it, and I certainly feel I could have done many things differently and better. But then you can't change the past, but you can change the future. So when you look at the future, you have an opportunity. Every day you have an opportunity to do something special and an opportunity to... a chance that God gives you, really, in life. I mean, again, I think I'll bring in a bit more religious thing in there because you're talking to an imam. I'm going to put in the religious aspect there. Every morning when... you wake up as a Muslim, you are taught a prayer that in Arabic is Alhamdulillahi alladhi ahyana ba'da ma matana wa ilayhi nushur, that all praise belongs to Allah, God, who gave me life after death, and to him shall we return. So I think that's a really good reminder as a prayer to you, that there are many people who don't wake up after their sleep, they die in their sleep, or they might not get a chance to live another day. So that chance is from God. So use that in the best possible way, obviously without pressure, but you do the best you can with the day. Try to make the day better than the day you passed. And then every time when you go to sleep, we are told to pray this prayer that Allahumma bismika amutu wa ahya, that with the name of God do I die and then wake up. So the Prophet said that every time you should go to sleep, you should always think, how did you spend your day? What good things did you do and what bad things did you do? What are your weaknesses? How can you improve on that? And when you wake up, try to improve.
Well, it has been such a huge privilege to meet you. Such wise words and so much to reflect on. Thank you so much, Safir, for being my guest this week.
Thank you. It was lovely. It was a very different experience because on the TV and when you are in a different program, you don't get to talk that much. So I really liked it.